Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has over 120 podcasts containing information about aviation technologies and pilot experiences for general and business aviation, from home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech. Plain Talk provides information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 2,200 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology, telecommunications, and aviation industries. Okay, we're here in the Plain Talk cockpit with the Royal Canadian Air Force, retired vets at the Sunnybrook Hospital, L-Wing, with Captain Mort Lightstone, affectionately known in our family as Uncle Mort. Welcome to the Plain Talk cockpit. Before I forget, thank you for your service.
Oh, it's, yes, you don't have to thank me. It was a pleasure. I served for 28 years. I acquired just under 7,000 hours as a long-range navigator. My specialty was a global celestial navigator. So I had many of my missions would take me across the Pacific or across the Atlantic or the High Arctic, all over the world.
Every continent except Antarctica, if I recall.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe next week?
Maybe.
I understand that the Department of Defense has a new recruiting need with the military shrinking. Maybe they'll ask folks like yourself with a wealth of knowledge to put the uniform back on.
Well, there's a lot of us here that are quite prepared to put the uniform back on, but we'd have to do most of our work at the slow march cadence.
Of course, I was earlier this afternoon visiting with Brigadier General Paul Hayes, retired, who was telling me all about his sorties in F-86 Sabre aircraft.
Yeah, General Hayes is well known, particularly with the flying requirements during the Cold War. He was lucky enough to have the role of training the German Air Force as a part of NATO to take up defensive positions against the possibility of attack from Russia. At the time, General Hayes was an aerobatic specialist with the Sabre aircraft.
Yeah, totally amazing coming out of high school and into the reserves, flying all kinds of cool airplanes in the height of the Cold War out of CFB Downsview. I think he was able to jump into a Vampire jet.
Yeah.
So you're going to brief the Plain Talk audience on this interesting World War II German radio navigation system. What was it called?
Consul. The German submarine fleet had a problem with their navigation across at various parts of the Atlantic. When they surfaced at night to fix their position on the stars, quite often there'd be an overcast and they needed a backup system. And the German engineers devised a system called Consul. It's a transmitting system, and just to put it into perspective, it's based on or similar to the concept of our airways that most of the audience, I assume most of the audience have been flying on our flight plan using the Canadian and the U.S. airway system, which of course is common throughout the world. In the case of the airways, we use the Morse code for the letter alpha and nan, A and N. And if you're right on the airway, you get a steady hum, but I don't want to go too much into the explanation of the airway system. I want to talk about Consul. By mid-war, the submarine, German submarine fleet was a significant annoyance to the Allies and their shipping of war supplies to various destinations in the United Kingdom and after the invasion in Europe. So they had to get this a navigation system that they could rely on. Of course, the best one to use is Astro, the stars, as I mentioned earlier. But they came up with a slight twist on the airway system. Instead of transmitting an alpha or a nan, they transmitted dots and dashes. But the pattern of transmission was a series of sectors where they would transmit up to 60 dots, and the next sector would be 60 dashes. And the subsequent sector would be 60 dots, followed by 60 dashes, followed by 60 dots, etc. They transmit that pattern out over the Atlantic, but the pattern of transmission would sweep from the beginning of a sector, from the first dot, and the whole radius would swing through, not 360 degrees, but roughly 5 or 6 degrees, but sweeping through the 60 dots, and then it would flash back and repeat that pattern. So wherever you were, if you're listening to the station, you would hear, let's say, 28 dots, and then you would hear 32 dashes. So you're on the 32-dot line. Now, the stations that they were transmitting were located in Spain at a place called Seville, and going north from there to Luso, L-U-S-O. They had a transmitter in France, in Quimper, that's Q-U-I-M-P-E-R. Further north, in Norway, they transmitted from Stavanger, S-T-A-V-A-N-G-E-R. So they would transmit from all these stations. The identification of the transmitting station, and then you'd hear the dots if you were on a dot line, and followed by the number of dashes, or if you heard the dashes first, you're on a dash line. Now, I've got a map spread out in front of me. The typical map that I used when I did the transatlantic flying. And in addition to getting position lines using pressure pattern techniques, I often used the console lines and additionally Loran lines. The map I'm looking at covers 80% of a large bed. It's a pretty large map. The scale of the map is 1 in 6 million. My goodness, a pencil line is almost 5 kilometers wide. The variety of stations going up from Spain through France and Norway would give you lines that crossed, similar to Loran. Loran is mostly East Coast, North America system of transmitters. But I'm sure you're familiar with Loran, or those that have studied either aviation navigation or naval navigation. Loran is quite common, and probably in a more sophisticated state since I used it, because certainly they've made advancements in the technology.
Well, sadly, Loran was decommissioned a number of years ago.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, in favor of global positioning satellites or GPS. What we've been talking about is transmitting bases deployed in World War II to support the navigation of World War II Nazi German submarines. But is it fair to say that the navigators
on the ships, the subs, or aircraft that were leveraging this technology didn't have any fancy receivers that would automatically plot where they were. They were using radio and listening and counting the dots or the dashes.
Correct.
Fortunately, in a ship, they don't go very fast, so unlike an airplane, so they had the time to count and recount. You can imagine 1, 2, 20, 21. Oops, I just forgot one. Are we at 22 or 23? And then start all over again. You mentioned that the station identifier was at the beginning of the transmission. Would that have been in Morse code? How was that identified?
Yeah, it was in Morse code. But the frequency of those five or six stations were separated. The gaps between the frequency was large enough that you knew what station you were listening to. So that was easy. The significant thing was once the Allies found information about the German system, and at the same time, by capturing German ships, they knew the location of the transmitters. And the first reaction was, let's go and bomb those locations and eliminate the German system. But at the same time, the bombing raids against Germany were becoming more difficult from the navigation perspective. And somebody questioned whether or not those dots and dashes were transmitted in a radial pattern in such a way that it could actually use to navigate over mainland Europe and use it as a nav system to bomb Germany. And that was, in fact, true. And the Allies used the Consul system on many of the bombing raids against Germany, so it helped the Allied war effort. And to my knowledge, Consul is still working today. At least it was working up until the time I retired. I'm not quite sure how I could establish if it's still transmitting.
When did you retire?
I retired in 1978.
Wow, so that's a lot of bang for a technology.
Yeah.
Very long time.
Yeah. They probably have, I wouldn't want to make a guess at whether they're still operating or not. But this chart, the 1 in 6 million scale, the method used to create the chart is the polar stereographic. Polar stereographic is where they simulate putting a flat plate tangential to the Earth at the North Pole, light source in the center of the reduced Earth, shining up onto that plate, and that's how they construct the map. This map in particular has some very interesting navigation information, plus some other stuff. I just want to talk about one thing. I don't know how much the listening audience might be aware of the rescue ships that are located at different points all over the Atlantic and the Pacific. They sit on a designated position. The ship is there for 6 weeks at a time. They're there to assist aircraft or ships that need help. They provide navigational information and weather information. So you can contact a ship that you might be, your path might be going close to them, and they'll give you a distance and bearing from the ship's location. And they're known phonetically by the standard alphabet characters, Alpha, Delta, Charlie, and so on. And I'm looking at the grid that surrounds the location of each of these rescue ships. It's very interesting to know that they're there, and I've talked to them many, many times on transatlantic flights. Interesting, or it helps with the navigation, get a bearing and distance. And when you fix your position, you can look at your forecast maps of the weather and determine whether or not ahead of you the winds are what have been forecast, so you can adjust your ETAs and those meet those sort of requirements.
And if you happen to be ferrying a light general aviation aircraft over the North Atlantic, a great place to be near if you have to ditch. So the rescue folks off the ship could, if you happen to ditch right beside them, could pick you up, and in an hour you could be having cognac with the captain.
Yes, that would be very neat. From that perspective, one of the bits of information that I remember, if you had to ditch, of course, it's very difficult to know your actual height as you're descending, because in the dark, particularly in darkness, there's no features around. No matter how high the waves are, you can't really assess whether they're 20 feet or 2 inches. But in any case, the rule of thumb is, in all the transport aircraft I flew in while I was in the Air Force, we had a facility of putting out an antenna trailing behind the aircraft. If we were going to be in a situation where we're in a controlled ditching, we crank out the trailing antenna, push it right out, and it would be about 50 feet below the aircraft that is the leading edge of that antenna. And when that antenna touches the water, all the electronic instruments go ballistic, and you know you're 50 feet above the water.
Wow. And I guess if you're ditching, it doesn't really matter the condition of the instruments and avionics. You just want to know when's the right time to flare. And are you flaring into, as you said, a 2-inch wave or a 50-foot wave?
Yeah.
Completely different outcomes.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's a lot of training to understand these navigation systems pre-GPS, pre-LORAN.
Especially from the military perspective, we've got to remember that any electronic system can be jammed by the enemy, or the enemy can use it. As I discussed earlier, the Allied forces did use the enemy's electronic system to navigate over Europe.
That's one of the challenges with the GPS system from a non-military perspective, which is when the GPS signals are jammed or spoofed by villains that subsequently will send an aircraft off course. Big problem.
Yeah, like I can assure you that in wartime, the GPS system based on the satellites will all be shut down.
Other than the Russian system called Glasnost.
I've known nothing about what Russia's been doing.
Russia has put up their own GPS system. And a lot of the commercial-grade GPS receivers that aviators fly with will talk to both systems. Certainly some of the handheld systems. I have a handheld receiver from our friends at Dual Electronics, and it will talk to both constellations. Because as you said, in wartime, the first thing the Americans are going to do, control the GPS system, will turn it off.
But we can or still jam it.
Or they'll just turn it off. But they'll keep the military side hot. I'm curious when, you know, we had our 9/11 incident, whether the Americans turned the GPS system off after they grounded all North American flights.
They did turn GPS off on 9/11. I saw the board, or the operational screen that their air traffic control system uses nationally. So it showed with a little icon every aircraft that was in the sky. And as everyone knows, all aircraft were instructed to land at the closest airport. But it was amazing to watch those little icons being turned off one by one, and the screen progressively got more black space until it was totally black.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So what would be one of the highlights of your military career?
Highlights of my military career? Well, I flew on the Korean airlift during the Korean War. We moved, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or million pounds of freight. carried many passengers back and forth across the Pacific. Some interesting things about the Korean War that I learned in my progress through those years. When the North Koreans had their surprise attack against the South, they moved down that peninsula so fast because they caught the South armed forces unprepared for the attack. They went back and forth up and down that peninsula. At the time, General MacArthur was the commander of the Allied forces in the Far East. And he pushed more and more troops that he had available to him into the South. And at one point, the North had marched all the way down to the Allied forces had a small foothold around a port city on the south coast of South Korea. And the local city was called Pusan. Pusan was just about ready to fall when General MacArthur pulled off what was considered a stroke of military genius, where he attacked by an armada more than halfway up the west coast of Korea near a place called Incheon. He landed 30,000 Marines, and they dashed across the peninsula, trapping the North Korean army in the south and cutting off their supply line. He attacked with an armada of about 450 warships, somewhere between 450 and 500. The amazing thing is that that happened in the third or fourth month of the war. Where the heck could you get that number of warships in such a short period of time? And I eventually did find out. Many of you would remember at the end of the Second World War, when the Japanese surrendered, they surrendered, in fact, to General MacArthur aboard a U.S. warship, and General MacArthur was flanked by 30 or 40 of his generals, and the Japanese representatives were a few Japanese generals and also some politicians with their top hats and whatnot. They signed the surrender. Well, amongst the instructions and demands in that surrender was that Japan will maintain its military fleet. Most of those warships that attacked at Incheon under the command of General MacArthur was the Japanese naval fleet from the Second World War.
So General MacArthur just commandeered the fleet and said, folks, we're going to load you up with Marines and Army and other soldiers and move swiftly and quickly into South Korea.
He already had them. In fact, I somewhere in my collection of trivia, I have the assembly plan from what ports the Japanese fleet was split in several ports, but the assembly of bringing them out of the ports and gathering as the attack armada. And it was very successful. But, you know, the fact that he used the Japanese fleet from the Second World War is kind of amazing.
Well, Uncle Mart, again, thank you for your service and thank you for being part of the Plain Talk podcast.
It's been a pleasure and happy landings to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plain Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plain Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at plaintalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at plaintalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.